Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. Vatican news this week has been very varied. In this program, Joan Lewis and I look back at some of the events of the past few days. Put out into deep water and pay out your nets for a catch. A carpenter gave instructions to experienced fishermen, and they obeyed him. Gilbert Villacqua and Sean Patrick Lovett reflect on the Gospel for this Sunday.
As the crowd pressed in on Jesus to hear the word of God, he saw two boats moored by the side of the lake. The fishermen had disembarked and were washing their nets. He got into one of the boats, the one belonging to Simon, and asked him to pull out a short distance from the shore. Then, remaining seated, he continued to teach the crowds from the boat. When he'd finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into deep water and lower your nets for a catch." Simon answered, "Master, we have been hard at it all night long and have caught nothing. But if you say so, I will lower the nets." Upon doing this, they caught such a great number of fish that their nets were at the breaking point. They signaled to their mates in the other boats to come and help them. These came, and together they filled the two boats until they nearly sank. At the sight of this, Simon Peter fell at the knees of Jesus, saying, "Leave me, Lord. I am a sinful man." For indeed, amazement at the catch they had made seized them and all his shipmates, as well as James and John, Zebedee's sons, who were partners with Simon. Jesus said to Simon, "Do not be afraid. From now on, you will be catching men." With that, they brought their boats to land, left everything, and became his followers.
We've come to that most familiar of scenes, that most significant of gospel episodes, the miraculous draught of fish and the calling of the first disciples. Jesus is standing by the lake, the crowd pressing in on him. He sees two boats moored by the lakeside, and nearby are the fishermen washing their nets. In Mark and Matthew's Gospels, the calling of the first four disciples is presented differently. We're told that Peter and Andrew are casting their nets, when he calls them and tells them, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." And they left their nets at once and followed him. And going on from there, we read, he sees the other two, James and John, with their father Zebedee, mending their nets. And at his call, they too follow him immediately, leaving nets, boat, father, with the men he employed, adds Mark. Neither Mark nor Matthew recount the miracle described by Luke in such detail. They concentrate on the call and the immediate response. No hesitation. They also use the plural when Jesus calls the disciples. "I will make you fishers of men." Mark, who was Peter's amanuensis, would have received from him only what Peter wanted recorded. And as one writer comments, Peter was not given to telling of miracles that involved himself. As for Matthew, the tax collector, a great haul of fish would not have impressed him in the same way as a miracle of healing. But for Luke, the figure of Peter stands out in this account. It is his boat that Jesus chooses to teach from. And throughout its centuries, the church has been referred to as Peter's boat, or more poetically, the bark of Peter, and represented as such by artists. The most famous of these was the so-called Navicella of Giotto, a mosaic showing the bark of St. Peter tossed among the waves and Christ walking in on the waters. It can still be seen today, or a fragment of it, scarcely distinguished among the shadows, writes Georgina Masson. Recovered from old St. Peter's when it was demolished in 1506, the mosaic was placed inside the porch over the central arch in the new basilica. Giotto made the mosaic in 1289, and we're told was paid 2,200 gold florins for his work. And it's said of Cardinal Baronius, disciple of St. Philip Neri, that whenever he passed this symbolic representation of Christ's church, he reverently uncovered his head. A charming legend is recounted by Irish poet Seamus Heaney. It regards the monastery of Clonmacnoise in County Offaly. Once the most celebrated religious foundation in the country, it's now only a melancholy ruin. But, writes Max Caulfield, well worth a visit.
Magnificently set in a sylvan bend of the Shannon, the longest natural waterway in the British Isles, this ancient walled monastic site is best approached by boat along the river from Athlone, so that its antique graves, early Christian buildings, round towers and high crosses rise majestically out of the morning mists that cloud in across the water.
And with that atmospheric introduction, let's listen now to the poem.
The annals say, when the monks of Clonmacnoise were all at prayers inside the oratory, a ship appeared above them in the air. The anchor dragged along behind so deep, it hooked itself into the altar rails, and then, as the big hull rocked to a standstill, a crewman shinned and grappled down the rope and struggled to release it, but in vain. This man can't bear our life here and will drown, the abbot said, unless we help him. So they did. The freed ship sailed, and the man climbed back out of the marvellous as he had known it.
The episode recounted in the Gospel probably took place in the neighbourhood of Capernaum, where Jesus had settled after he had left Nazareth. An ancient fishing town on the northwestern shore of the lake, it had also become Peter's town. He and his brother originally came from Bethsaida, another fishing town, as its name, which means house of fishing, implies. Although its exact site is not known, we read in the guidebook.
It is commonly accepted that Bethsaida was located on the northeastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, in the Beteka Valley, a marshy area where rivers coming down from the Golan Heights drain into the sea.
The people of Bethsaida, we know from the Gospels, didn't accept Jesus and his teachings, and together with Chorazin was cursed by him. Woe to thee, Bethsaida! For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. So we read in Matthew, and the guidebook concludes.
It is thought that the curse was so powerful that Bethsaida completely disappeared from memory.
And what did Peter think, I wonder? The town of Mary Magdalene was also on the western shore of the lake and was, writes the guidebook, a fish products industrial centre, adding that its Greek name, Trakai, means the place for salting the fish. H.V. Morton, who writes that dyeing was the industry of Magdala, fills in the picture of the activities carried on in the lakeside area.
In the time of Jesus, the Sea of Galilee was one of the busiest centres of life in the country. The western shore was ringed with towns and villages, and the lake was crowded with ships. The trades carried on round the lake were boat building, dyeing at Magdala, pottery works and fish curing. The large curing factory was at Tarikaya, the pickling place to the south of the lake, where fish were salted and packed for export. There was always a big market for salt fish in Jerusalem. In Old Testament times, the fish trade seems to have been in the hands of the Tyrians and the Egyptians. The fish gate of ancient Jerusalem, round which the fish market was held, lay near the northern gate, the natural entrance from Tyre. It seems fairly certain, however, that about 50 years before the time of Christ, the Greeks broke this monopoly by introducing the fish-curing industry to the Sea of Galilee. Pliny says that in his time, the pickling place at Tarikaya gave its name to the whole lake, which suggests that the industry must have been at first a Greek enterprise. The trade must have expanded enormously, for we know that barrels of these cured fish were carried all over the Mediterranean world, and that enormous quantities were sent to Jerusalem every spring for the Passover crowds on pilgrimage to the temple.
And so, on that day in May, for so it apparently was, Jesus stood by the lake, which was still enveloped in the mists of early morning. There would have been plenty of noise, though, even at that time, from the shouts of fishermen who'd had a good catch and were on their way down to the curing sheds, to the hammers of the boat builders and the general hubbub and bustle of a busy place of this kind. Added to this, the throngs that would have accompanied Jesus from the moment it was known that he was in the vicinity. Jesus is speaking to them, but as the crowds increase and people push each other, as they do, in an effort to hear and see better, he finds himself more or less imprisoned on three sides. But then he spots the empty boats, moored nearby, and the fishermen, who are his friends. Indeed, also his disciples, though not yet totally committed. But that situation will be very soon rectified. Jesus steps into the boat of Simon Peter and asks him to pull out a bit from the shore. He then sits down in the boat and resumes his preaching. We're not told what he said to the crowds that day. It's what happened afterwards that Luke wants us to know. The first words quoted here are, put out into deep water, or in that older, euphonious phrase, launch out into the deep. One can almost hear the crunch of the pebbles and the rush of water as the boat slides out. Pope John Paul II has often quoted this phrase and once declared that the Lord's invitation was almost the motto of his apostolic letter, Novo Millennio Eneunte, at the beginning of the new millennium.
As the successor of Peter, I feel it my duty to echo these words of Christ to the whole church. Christ, who is the same yesterday and today and forever, urges every ecclesial community to put out into the deep, to go forward in hope into the new millennium, which opens before us like a vast ocean on which to venture.
And now, for the first time in the Gospels, we hear Peter's voice.
Master, we have laboured all the night and have taken nothing, but at thy word I will let down the net.
For Peter, expert fisherman, the command to put out into the deep water and lower the nets for a catch, when they'd been out all night labouring fruitlessly and had only just come ashore with nothing to show for their efforts, must have seemed like sheer madness, folly, against all reason. And Peter makes his point, brusquely if you like, sincerely, frankly, for that was his way. But he immediately adds words of faith in the master he has already accepted without reserves. Writes one scholar,
the account of the miraculous haul of fish stresses Peter's obedience and his readiness with regard to Jesus. It also, however, shows how Peter's mission is founded only on the action of Jesus. Peter, in fact, knows he is a sinner.
Peter launches the boat into deep water, and he and his brother let down the nets.
And when they had done this, they netted such a huge number of fish that their nets began to tear. So they signaled to their companions in the other boat to come and help them.
Lake Galilee is not particularly deep, and its waters are generally calm. But when the boats draw closer to shore and shallower water, there is a danger. H.V. Morton, our constant guide, explains.
The Galilean fisherman who nets a heavy catch is always anxious about the net, because the bottom of the lake is covered with sharp stones for perhaps 20 or 30 feet before the sand begins. What a shouting goes up as a heavy net is drawn out of the deep water towards the sharp stones. With what care the fishermen run thigh-deep into the lake to lift the precious burden clear of rocks.
The same writer, referring to the miracle St. John recounts after the resurrection, notes the concern of the evangelist for this same reason. Again, they fish all night and catch nothing. And at daybreak, Jesus stands on the shore and tells them to cast on the right side of the boat. And when they do, they are not able to haul it in for the quantity of fish. 103 large fish, John notes. And yet, although there were so many, the net was not torn. The amount of detail in John's account our writer believes to be a conclusive proof that John was a Galilean and a fisherman. On that occasion, he was the only one who recognised the risen Jesus and told Peter, who pulled on his clothes and waded to the shore. But, writes John, the other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards off. John actually uses the word cubits, equivalent to some 46 centimetres. So the boat was about 100 metres from the shore. A legend of Franciscan tradition relates that somewhere in the back streets of Jerusalem is the site of a house which belonged to Zebedee, father of St. John. This family apparently were fish merchants of Galilee, with a branch office in Jerusalem from which they used to supply, among others, the family of Caiaphas, the high priest. and this would explain the mysterious reference in John's Gospel to the fact that he, who refers to himself as that other disciple, was admitted to the house of the high priest after the arrest of Jesus, because he was known to the doorkeeper. Let's refresh our memory. Jesus has been arrested, taken first to Annas and now to Caiaphas. Writes John.
Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. As this disciple was known to the high priest, he entered the court of the high priest along with Jesus, while Peter stood outside at the door. So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the maid who kept the door, and brought Peter in.
Well, it may be only a legend, but it throws a whole new light on that scene in the high priest's house in the early hours of that first Good Friday morning. And how otherwise, writes one, could the son of Zebedee from Galilee be known to the doorkeeper of the house of the most important man in Jerusalem? Legends aside, the miracle recounted in today's Gospel regards the action and reaction of Peter, the big fisherman, and the words of our Lord spoken in answer. Peter had seen other miracles performed by Jesus, water turned to wine, miracles of healing, which to us might seem more significant than a great haul of fish. But fish were Peter's life, and this was the miracle that impressed him most profoundly, as it did his companions. But why the sudden realization of sinfulness? Comments Sheed.
Precisely because the miracle hit home to him in all the reality of its miraculousness, he suddenly saw Christ for the first time. Seeing Christ, he at last saw himself.
But Jesus reassures Peter, who has withdrawn from him, physically and even spiritually, suddenly aware of the seemingly unsurmountable abyss which separates them. And then come those words which will change the life of Peter and that of his companions forever.
Fear not, from henceforth thou shalt catch men. And having brought their ships to land, leaving all things, they followed him.
From the Gospel, we move on to the Vatican as Joan Lewis and I look back at the events of the past few days. Welcome back for another week, Joan.
And how it has flown by. A week of very interesting events, and as our listeners will hear, some rather unusual stories, kind of out of the normal framework of the news that we do. But the first story is within those normal parameters, and of course it involves Pope Benedict, and it was his meeting with the Roman Rota, which is the church tribunal that looks at and grants, when they can, marriage annulments. And to explain to a lot of listeners, it's really amazing how many people do not know this. An annulment that is granted by the church simply means that the marriage never existed in the first place. For that to happen, certain conditions have to exist. You have to find out that somebody was married at gunpoint, or somebody said that they told their spouse, oh yes, they want children, and then 6 months after their marriage, this goes off the table, and they tell their spouse they absolutely don't want children. So there are certain conditions under which annulments can be granted.
And an annulment is not the same thing as a divorce, because a divorce says that a marriage happened.
Took place, sure.
But an annulment says It was no marriage.
And that's why for anybody who calls an annulment a Catholic divorce, because I've heard that expression, they're wrong. Because again, divorce says a marriage took place, annulment says a marriage never took place. And then, of course, the two parties that contract are free to marry because they never... And
they were never married.
Well, you can't say even remarry because they were never married. But when the Holy Father met with the judges, defenders of the bond, the dean and so forth of the Roman Rota, in essence, he really talked about two things. First of all, he really urged them to make annulments the exception rather than the rule and to grant them as rarely as possible. And then he really talked about the state of marriage today. And in essence, what his talk was about was marriage is between a man and a woman and is an indissoluble bond. But what he said that really struck me, he talked about the relativism and juridical positivism that consider marriage as a mere social formalization of the ties of affection. I mean, kind of sit back and think about those words. And so he says, kind of summing up in another way, he says, marriage thus appears as a superimposed legal structure which people can manipulate at will, even denying its heterosexual character. So here he's making a reference to de facto unions, which, of course, Italy, the Italian government, is considering a law that would allow de facto unions between heterosexuals or homosexuals and giving people the same legal rights as a married man and woman couple. And the Pope talked about the indissolubility of marriage, saying, actually, it can't be denied on the grounds that this is just an ideal that you can't possibly hope to achieve. He said, the indissolubility of marriage is intrinsic to the nature of the powerful bond established by the Creator. So it was God who created marriage, the union of a man and a woman, and the Pope quoted the book of Genesis. He said, the Creator made the male and female. And for this reason, a man shall leave his mother and father and be joined to his wife, and the two shall be one. So we are talking a man and a woman in a lasting union. I saw a headline in one paper that said, a wife is for life. And I got a big kick out of that expression. In any event, a lot of what the Holy Father said to the Rota was listened to very carefully by Italians, since their lawmakers are considering a law that would grant, which the church and the Italian lawmakers are on totally opposite sides of the fence here as far as the issue of de facto unions. For the church, it's not even thinkable, much less doable. And then the Italian lawmakers are indeed thinking of it. Now, President Napolitano has come up with, when he was in Spain, he said he hoped that some kind of agreement could be made whereby the Catholic Church would have its own proposal, which lawmakers would accept. But I don't think so.
What the Pope had to say would also support the church in England, for instance, which is struggling at the moment because Parliament is trying to pass a law saying that it is all right for gay couples to adopt a child, and is not giving the church or any of the other bodies, because
an exception,
other
yeah.
Christian bodies, also the Jews and the Muslims, are all saying, well, this is wrong. A gay couple can't adopt a child because a child needs a mother
and a
father.
Exactly. I've been following that story too, and it really, really is sad how all of a sudden even majorities are not having a voice anymore. It's an issue we'll be following for quite some time, and even after, you know, I'd like to think they weren't going to do it, but even after the Italian lawmakers come up with some kind of a law, I just can't imagine it being a law that is acceptable even in the smallest part to the Catholic Church. You know, another story we're going to be following is in a totally different theme. It refers to Benedict's predecessor, of course, John Paul II. The Pope's former secretary, now Cardinal Stanislaw Krzywica of Krakow, Poland, has written a book called A Life with Carol. It came out in Italy on January, the end of January, and it came out in Poland, I think, just several days ago. He and the cardinal have this conversation in the course of which the cardinal comes out with an awful lot of things that people are hearing for the first time about John Paul. For example, that actually there was one point in his illness when he did consider resigning for the good of the church, and also even thought of penning a document that said that popes should resign at 80, and then decided to, of course, do as he had always done and put everything in the hands of God in divine providence. And we know the rest of that story. Other wonderful, interesting things, well, skiing. We knew a couple times during his pontificate when he went out, like on a quiet Tuesday afternoon when there's usually nothing on a papal agenda, and he went skiing. But apparently there were about 100 times when he left the Vatican in an unmarked car. Even the Vatican security did not know this, and he went out skiing. So he made a lot of clandestine trips, well, skiing or hiking, actually, in the mountains, which were great loves of his as sports. We learned that the man who wanted to kill him, when he shot him, they didn't think the Pope was going to live. And doctors, when they were going through the surgery, were absolutely stunned, of course, that he made it. They really didn't think that, despite their best efforts, that he was going to make it. So it's a lot of wonderful, revealing things. Some are really kind of strike you, like the skiing. Others, less known facts about the Pope, but very heartwarming thing.
Now you had an unusual story about fasting.
I really was interested in doing this story. I had heard that the Chaldean Catholics in Iraq, under the urging of Patriarch Emmanuel Deli of Baghdad of the Chaldeans, had a three-day fast called Nineveh's Fast. I mean, this goes back several, almost, you know, two millennia, and actually has its roots in the Bible. And it is a period of fasting. It is 3 days. It occurs in the fifth month of the lunar year and precedes the start of what we now have today as Lent by exactly 3 weeks. So it was of the week just past. It was Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of this week. And what the people have to fast from is from eating fish, meat, and milk derivatives from dawn to dusk. Now, this goes back to the book of Jonah, where, of course, the Lord came to Jonah and told him to set out for the great city of Nineveh and announce to it a message that I will tell you. And to make a great story very brief, basically the threat was to, because of its evil ways and the lives of its people, Nineveh was going to be destroyed by the Lord. Well, they were given a reprieve. The people showed the Lord that they were going to turn from their evil ways. And the Lord repented from the destruction he was going to bring on the city and did not carry it out. So to commemorate the conversion of the citizens of Nineveh, which, by the way, is on the eastern bank of the Tigris River in modern-day Mosul, Iraq, the Chaldean church yearly celebrates this feast, Nineveh's Fast. And it began with a mass in Aramaic on Monday morning, and then there was a second mass later in Arabic. And this Nineveh's fast has been observed for many centuries. It fell into disuse and was revived in the 6th century when the bishops of Nineveh and Beth-Garmi resumed this tradition. Their peoples were being threatened by a great plague. They decided to have this fast. And the patriarch at the time, Ezekiel, declared that a 3-day fasting period be observed forever. So a very interesting feast day, which I had never heard of before this. And I'm
sure most of our listeners had never heard of it.
I think with Iraq making so much of the headlines, that anything involving, especially these days, Christians in Iraq, too, has tended to find its way into the news. And there's a very interesting website called Baghdad Hope, and it's a website of Chaldean Christians. Iraqi Chaldean
God,
Christians.
They'll have peace.
Exactly.
You have been listening to me, Sister Janet Ferns, and to Joan Lewis, Jill Bevilacqua, and Sean Patrick Lovett. You can hear us all again at the same time next week, or at your leisure, by going to the internet and clicking on English at vaticanradio.org. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.